The headlines this hour: Iran and Belarus sign cooperation agreements in different fields as presidents of the two countries meet in the capital, Tehran. President Xi says China must modernize its military to make it into a great wall of steel that ensures the country's security. And most Asian markets fall amid fears of financial crisis after the closure of two regional U.S. banks. Well, welcome to the studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us.
Iran and Belarus signed a comprehensive roadmap for cooperation during the Belarusian president's visit to Tehran. The two countries also signed 8 agreements for cooperation in economic and agricultural sectors, among others. During the signing ceremony, Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi said the document will boost bilateral ties. Raisi also said that Iran looks forward to cooperate with Belarus in international bodies, including the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. He added that Tehran is ready to share with Belarus its experience in dealing with sanctions. Alexander Lukashenko, for his part, stressed that anti-Iran sanctions failed to impede Iran's progress. He added that the two countries see eye to eye on international issues and called for enhanced cooperation in different sectors. Lukashenko is also expected to hold talks with other senior Iranian officials. Iran and Belarus signed a comprehensive roadmap for cooperation during the Belarusian president's visit to Tehran. The two countries also signed 8 agreements for cooperation in economic and agricultural sectors, among others. During the signing ceremony, Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi said the document will boost bilateral ties. Raisi also said Iran looks forward to cooperate with Belarus and international bodies, including the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. He added that Tehran is ready to share with Belarus its experience in dealing with sanctions. Iran's foreign ministry says the agreement for restoration of ties between Iran and Saudi Arabia can help boost regional cooperation on peace and stability. The ministry spokesman said preparations are being made for a meeting between the two countries' foreign ministers in the near future. Nasser Kanani made the comment in his weekly presser. He also said that Iran is ready for a prisoner swap with the U.S. on humanitarian grounds. Kanani said the swap will be possible if the U.S. adopts a realistic approach on the issue. The spokesman said the exchange was agreed as part of the deal that Iran and the U.S. signed last March. He said the swap was put on hold after the U.S. tied the deal to the negotiations for the revival of the nuclear deal. He also said that Iran and the U.S. are in contact on the prisoner swap deal. IRB, World Service News Awards for TV, radio, and social media productions, has praised its flagship news channels in Arabic, English, and Spanish for offering a new perspective to their audience worldwide in a world where mainstream media sets the narrative. Gisumi Shahmedi attended the ceremony.
Creating a world where untold stories are told and unheard voices are heard. The annual IRIB World Service News Awards, dubbed SOAP Media Festival, this year had a lot to celebrate.
It's been a few years that the dynamics are changing and the new world order is emerging. The unipolar world is now turning into a multipolar world. Iran is in a position where it can speed up this process and offer a third viewpoint different from the two narratives that have always existed.
Words that clarify the mission of IRIB World Service. And this is exactly why the Arabic news channel Al Alam swept the IRIB World Service News Awards, taking home wins in nearly every major category, with its sister channel Al Alam Syria TV maintaining front-runner status with its popular talk show, Zoom Room.
We are proud to be able to gain a strong foothold in Syria and West Asia in particular by shedding light on the truth and covering stories that are untold about people who have been misrepresented.
I've been with Al Alam for more than 8 years now. I have hosted many TV programs. It's great to be part of a team where the goal is to bring truth to light.
Meanwhile, the Spanish-language news channel Hispan TV, as well as Press TV, were seen as the gold standard of achievement in the television community, winning awards in different sections, including the Best Documentary and the Best News Website. Not to mention that Press TV's Palestine Declassified won the Best Political TV Show.
This is the moment we're in. We're in the end, the dying throes of US hegemony. And as he was saying, I very much agree with, the cultural infrastructure for the ending of hegemony has to be put in place, and that involves media, including news and journalism, which can give a different view of how the world is operating and tell more of the truth about the world. So, you know, the media play a central, important role in all that.
Press TV correspondent Johnny Miller, who has covered the most difficult news stories, including the Rohingya crisis and the developments in Ukraine over the past year, was not left out.
I think two of my heroes, Noam Chomsky and John Pilger, said that they've never seen as much propaganda in the war in Ukraine than in any war that they've reported on or written about, and they've reported right back from Vietnam. So that's telling you a lot. And there's a huge amount of propaganda on Ukraine. Indeed, Ukraine is it's a civil war, but it's also a proxy war between Russia and NATO. And I think we're seeing the beginning of this split between the West and the East, China, Russia, Iran. And we're seeing a challenge to American hegemony and indeed the creation of this new multipolar world.
And according to the head of the Islamic Republic of Iran Broadcasting, IRIB World Service is at the forefront of this propaganda war.
In this unequal war, where IRIB World Service has none of the advantages of mainstream media, from state-of-the-art technology to political support, it has been able to blaze a new trail. The fact that its news channels are frequently banned on different social media platforms is testimony to that. Meanwhile, this also proves in practice that the free flow of information and free speech are nothing more than slogans that are used as political tools by advocates of democracy.
Media play a key role in today's world. They can set the tone for diplomatic endeavors, and they are a tool of international communication. Particularly for the Islamic Republic of Iran, its media outlet can pave the way for diplomacy.
That is why there are great expectations, which means that so far, IRIB World Service has been able to deliver on its responsibilities.
In a world where mainstream media is setting the narrative, IRIB World Service has been able to break the monopoly and offer a new perspective. Gizumish Ahmadi, Tehran.
Saudi Arabia has reportedly refused to give visas to an Israeli delegation invited to attend a UN conference on tourism. A report says the UN World Tourism Organization had invited the Israeli delegation, along with representatives from 22 countries, for a two-day event in the Saudi city of Al Ula. But the Israelis were denied visas despite an appeal by UN officials and their request for equal treatment of the organization's members. The development comes as Israel has been trying hard to normalize relations with Saudi Arabia. Over the past years, some Arab states agreed to a U.S.-brokered normalization deal with Israel. But Riyadh failed to follow suit, insisting there will be no ties with Tel Aviv until the establishment of a state for Palestinians. The Israeli military pushes its atrocities in the occupied West Bank. The regime has abducted 14 Palestinians during the latest string of raids into the territory. The regime forces took the Palestinians into custody after storming their homes in several towns in the occupied West Bank. Israel has been carrying out raids in the occupied territories almost on a daily basis over the past months. The regime troopers have killed 84 Palestinians in the West Bank alone so far this year. More than a decade of Western attempts to overthrow the democratically elected Syrian government has failed. That's according to the leader of the Lebanese resistance movement, Hezbollah. However, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah says the West continues with its agenda to marginalize President Bashar al-Assad by stopping Arab countries' efforts to normalize relations with Damascus.
Almost a decade since foreign-backed terrorists in Syria tried to pull the country into chaos, it seems an all-out war against Damascus has failed. That's according to the Secretary General of the Lebanese Resistance Movement, Hezbollah. In a meeting with a large group of influential figures from various Arab and Islamic countries, Said Hassan Nasrallah asserted that many Arab states intend to normalize ties with Syria, but the United States opposes such moves. The Hezbollah chief stressed that Syria's real enemy is the United States, which is going ahead with its war and blockade against Damascus. He argued that Syria has been targeted by a U.S.-led scheme over its rejection to subdue to Washington. He pointed out that Washington's sanction measures against Damascus are failing with the help of the people and Syria's regional allies. In the televised address, Nasrallah hailed Syria for lying in the heart of a powerful axis of resistance, noting that there is confidence that the Arab country would remain at the forefront of the struggle to stand against the West. Nasrallah stressed that Syria's resistance disrupted all equations throughout the entire region. The Hezbollah leader also tied the security of Syria to its neighboring countries, namely Lebanon. He said what happens in Syria and Palestine is reflected directly on the regional countries and has a strong impact on Lebanon in particular. The prominent figure said speaking about the present and future of Syria is like speaking about the present and future of Lebanon. He noted that if Daesh terrorists, who had seized large swathes of land in Syria and Iraq from 2014 to 2017, had remained in the region, it would have affected Lebanon as well.
The remarks by Said Hassan Nasrallah come as Syria is standing firm against the Western pressure. The years-long conflict has not managed to stop the government from rebuilding the country. The administration of President Bashar al-Assad has also made all of its efforts to facilitate the return of refugees to Syria after more than a decade of foreign-backed militancy.
The comments by Hezbollah leader comes as many countries, especially those in the Arab world, are gradually turning towards Syria by normalizing relations with the Arab country. Countries like the United Arab Emirates, Jordan and Oman are among those who have recently restored their relations with Damascus. To add to the list is Tunisia, with President Rais Said announcing plans to fully restore ties with Syria, which was once cut off more than a decade ago. Needless to say that many of those countries join hand-in-hand with Western nations to sow division in Syria. They also helped the West impose an all-out economic sanction and blockade on Damascus. As Syrian Foreign Minister Faisal Miqdad has numerously said, hegemonic countries had implemented straitjacketed agendas, invested in terrorism, and put economies in a stranglehold with no regard for international law. Miqdad brands what he calls smart sanctions as a form of collective punishment against the Syrian people who are deprived of access to food, fuel, medications, and other basic necessities. As part of sanctions, the Western world has left no stone unturned to isolate Syria. But to what extent has that scheme been successful? Since the crisis in 2011, Syria has favored dialogue even with the opposition to support national reconciliation and stability. Moreover, Damascus has facilitated the return of millions of refugees who once escaped a foreign-backed militancy from Syria. The Syrian government has also made all its efforts to rebuild the country after large swathes of its land were devastated by terrorist acts. From the military perspective, President Bashar al-Assad, with the support of Iran and Russia, has emerged victorious from the years-long conflict. That could especially be highlighted when the Syrian government managed to retake almost all the territory it lost to foreign-backed terrorists. All in all, what seems to be of high significance is the fact that Syria, with the help of its allies, is managing to stand firm against the West's threats. From partitioning the Arab country to plundering the country's oil, Syria is doing whatever it can to resist against the West. That's exactly what the Hezbollah leader termed as failure of the West in its war on Damascus.
The Chinese president's call for the modernization of the country's military to make it, quote, a great wall of steel. Xi Jinping made the call in his first speech as the head of state in his third term as president and amid heightened tensions with the U.S. Xi said security is the foundation for development. He also reiterated China's opposition to secessionist activities and external interference in Taiwan. Beijing and Washington have seen their tensions soar over a number of issues, including the status of Taiwan and the U.S. crackdown on Chinese tech companies. China has openly warned the U.S. that it is ready to use its military to defend its interests. North Korea says it has test-fired two strategic cruise missiles from a submarine. South Korea and the United States kick off their biggest joint military drills in 5 years. North Korea says the missiles precisely hit an underwater target in the waters east of the Korean Peninsula. The country's state news agency says the test was linked to the U.S. and South Korea getting even more undisguised in their military drills against the North. The latest joint exercises will run for 10 days. The South Korean military says the maneuvers involve wartime procedures to repel potential North Korean attacks. Pyongyang views such exercises as rehearsals for invasion and has repeatedly warned that it would take reciprocal action. Hundreds of South Koreans have staged a rally in the capital, Seoul, to protest the upcoming military drills with the U.S. President Yoon Suk-yeol has vowed to strengthen the U.S.-South Korea alliance in the face of a record number of missiles launched by North Koreans last year. Frank Smith has more from Seoul.
South Koreans opposed to upcoming joint U.S.-South Korea military exercises took their message to the presidential office. They worry the largest such drills in almost 5 years could lead to direct conflict.
Where did all the efforts for dialogue for each other go? We must stop the terrible threat that will actually lead to the devastation of nuclear war. We have to stop the battle without an exit. That's why we're here.
Last year, North Korea test-launched a record number of ballistic missiles, with the U.S. and South Korea routinely conducting their own missile tests and smaller military drills.
The large-scale joint U.S.-South Korea military exercises had been suspended under previous President Moon Jae-in. But that's not the policy of current President Yoon Suk-yeol, who seeks to strengthen the alliance with the United States with the frequent deployment of U.S. nuclear-capable forces.
The drills are set to include both computer-simulated war games and field exercises. North Korea views the drills as a rehearsal for invasion.
Currently, the South Korea-U.S. joint military exercise is going ahead, generating aggressive tension, and includes a preemptive strike scenario. Wherever there is such a military exercise, tensions on the Korean Peninsula increase.
More large-scale drills with the U.S. are planned for this year, as President Yoon seeks to celebrate the 70th anniversary of South Korea's alliance with the United States. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Most Asian markets fall as the closure of two regional U.S. banks sparked fears of contagion in the financial sector. The collapse of Silicon Valley Bank on Friday, followed by the shutdown of Signature Bank in New York on Sunday, prompted a plunge in U.S. bank shares. The losses have now reached major lenders in Asia, with HSBC, National Australia Bank, and Mitsubishi UFJ bearing the brunt. The trend is also there in the broader equity markets. Tokyo Stock Exchange was down more than 1% on Monday, as indices also slid in other major markets except Hong Kong and Shanghai, which rallied. Moscow accuses Washington and London of sowing deception about an act of sabotage against Russia's Nord Stream pipeline in September. The secretary of Russia's National Security Council says no pro-Ukrainian group is capable of conducting such an act of sabotage on the country's most important energy corridor to Europe. Nikolai Petrushev says the Kremlin still is not certain about the identity of the saboteurs. However, he says the U.S. and Britain have the capability to blow the natural gas pipelines underneath the Baltic Sea. Washington and London have both rejected the allegation. Comments follow a report by the New York Times that a Ukrainian group might have carried out the attack. Prior to that, a U.S. investigative journalist said that Washington was behind the incidents. And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe, can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on October 3rd, 2022, during the joint graduation ceremony for the cadets studying in the academies of the Islamic Republic of Iran's armed forces. The ceremony was held in Imam Hassan al-Mushtaba alayhi salam University of Office and Police Training. These riots had been planned. If the incident with the young girl had not taken place, they have found another excuse to create insecurity and riots in the country in the beginning of the month of May, September, this year. Well, how can you not see foreign hands at play? How can an attentive person not sense that there are other hands behind the scenes of these events? Other policies are at play. Of course, they falsely pretend that they care that someone has passed away in the world. They are lying. They are not upset by this. They are not upset by this at all. In fact, they are happy. They are happy because they have a pretext for creating unrest. They lie.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Here, the heads of the three powers of the state, executive, legislative, judicial, expressed their sorrow and sympathized with the grieving family. Then certain elements murder other people who are innocent and have not committed any crime. The judiciary promised to follow up on this to the end. This is what investigations are all about. It means following up on a case, seeing the results, and seeing if anyone was guilty of something or not. And if someone was guilty, identify them. How can you make false accusations and insult such a huge organization that serves the people over the probability that perhaps one or two people have made a mistake before any research or proof has been presented? There is no logic behind this. It is clearly the work of none other than the spy agencies and malicious foreign politicians. Now, what is the motive of these foreign governments? My perception is that they feel that the country is progressing toward achieving a comprehensive power, and they cannot tolerate this. They can feel this and see it. They can see that many old problems are fortunately being solved. Although the country has many problems, some of which started years ago, but serious work is being done to solve these problems and untie these knots.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Fires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Trilateral meetings in progress in the capital, Beijing. The participants, Saudi Arabia's National Security Advisor, Mossad bin Mohammed al-Eban, Iran's Secretary of the Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, and Wang Yi, Director, Office of Foreign Affairs Commission, the Communist Party of China Central Committee. Then came the announcement. After 7 years, Iran and Saudi Arabia have resumed diplomatic ties. Meanwhile, Ali Shamkhani expressed willingness to continue constructive dialogue, fully implement their consensus, and enhance good neighborliness to jointly safeguard regional security.
At the end of the talks, we reached a decision to start a new chapter after 7 years of severed relations between the Islamic Republic of Iran and Saudi Arabia, while considering the interests of the two countries, the security and well-being of the region, and preventing undue intervention from extra-regional forces, particularly from the West, and constant mischief by the Zionist regime in the region. We hope that this new chapter will compensate for the stagnation of relations over these last 7 years and also lead to stability and security in the region, as well as the improvement of the welfare of all its people.
Saudi Arabia was also positive in its assessment of what this deal means. When it comes to the agreement itself, this is what we know. Both have agreed to restore diplomatic relations. This will be followed up by the reopening of embassies and missions within a period not exceeding 2 months. Per protocol, this means the exchange of ambassadors. The two countries agreed to implement the Agreement on Security Cooperation signed on April 17, 2001, and the General Agreement reached on May 27, 1998, aimed at fostering ties in economic, commercial investment, technical, and scientific fields, to name a few. Since the announcement of the restoration of ties between Iran and Saudi Arabia, there's been a tidal wave of responses and reactions. The U.S. President Joe Biden's response was clearly off the mark. He said better relations between Israel and their Arab neighbors are better for everybody. As for Israel, the opposition has been quick to react and has slammed Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. It said the restoration of diplomatic ties between Saudi Arabia and Iran represents a failure of foreign policy by Israel's longest-serving prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu. There's no doubt, however, that this is seen as a major defeat for the U.S. and its standing, especially when it comes to diplomacy. Mark Dubowitz, the chief executive of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, has said, "Lose, lose, lose for American interests." This agreement demonstrates the Saudis don't trust Washington to have their back. Iran sees opportunity to peel away U.S. allies to end international isolation. Although this may be a huge diplomatic victory for China, this is also a victory of Iranian policy when it came to Yemen and Saudi Arabia itself. Let's not forget, this was a face-saving deal for the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, since his Yemen policy was defeated due to the Ansarullah movement's dominance in Yemen. Saudi Arabia was also defeated in Syria when it backed Daesh terrorists with the help of his allies, like the U.S. Other issues leading to the severance of diplomatic ties included how Saudi Arabia executed prominent Shiite cleric Sheikh Nimr al-Nimr. Saudi Arabia was also responsible when it led Persian Gulf Arab monarchies to blacklist the Lebanese resistance group Hezbollah as a terrorist organization. Saudi's past behavior shows that it cannot be a trustworthy partner until certain actions are taken when it comes to issues like Yemen, Palestine, and Syria, where it has played destructive roles. It remains to be seen whether this agreement between Saudi Arabia and Iran to ensure the security of West Asia would translate into a decrease of the U.S. presence in the region to its eventual withdrawal completely.
France has been hit by yet another wave of mass strikes and protests. The row is about President Emmanuel Macron's controversial pension reforms. An estimated 1.28 million people have participated in the nationwide strike. The demonstrations were some of the biggest in decades. The nationwide strike have disrupted train services, shut schools, and halted fuel deliveries. Unions have stepped up their campaign to force a U-turn on a deeply unpopular policy. Workers from different sectors have walked out of their jobs and held demonstrations in Paris and other cities. Refineries have stopped fuel deliveries, most trains have come to a halt, and power production has decreased during the industrial action. Some scuffles have broken out on the sidelines, with some people throwing projectiles at police who responded with tear gas. Unions have threatened to freeze up the economy with work stoppages. Some unions have called for open-ended strikes in sectors from refineries and oil depots to electricity and gas facilities. This is the sixth time since the start of the year that unions called a nationwide day of strikes and demonstrations. The disruption is expected to be greater and last longer as rail unions call for rolling open-ended strikes. This could affect all national trains as well as international routes. Trains to Germany and Spain came to a halt, and those to and from the United Kingdom and Belgium were reduced by a third. Some students have also blockaded faculties, and some schools closed as teachers staged a one-day strike.
I don't want to work until I'm 64. I say to myself, enough already. For the moment, there are only promises made, and we don't know when it's going to end. So it's better to fight now than to lose our gains. That's it.
People are fed up. People are exhausted. People see around them that there are plenty of colleagues who don't even make it to the current legal retirement age. So how can we expect them to make it to 64? And then, for us, it's 64. But for the years to come and our children, what age will it be? 66? I think the government hasn't taken everything into account.
The strikes and industrial actions are about President Emmanuel Macron's unpopular pension reforms. His government is planning to raise the retirement age from 62 to 64 and increase the number of years of work required to claim a full pension. The change will be gradual, increasing by 3 months per year from September until 2030. From 2027, workers will have to make social security contributions over 43 years rather than 42 in order to get full pensions. The government says the reforms would boost the employment rate among 60 to 64-year-olds. In France, the employment rate in this age category is just 33% compared with 61% in Germany and 69% in Sweden.
Precisely, it is the most precarious people who are going to suffer the most from the reform and who are going to serve two more years. It is scandalous. Mrs. Born has never been a cleaning lady. She has never been a social worker for handicapped kids. She has never done work where you have to get up at 6 o'clock in the morning to go to work with cut-off hours, to work on Saturday nights, on Sundays. She does not know at all. She doesn't know what the people and the population go through. So yes, it is scandalous.
Macron has vowed to go ahead with the bill. The reforms were at the heart of the President Emmanuel Macron's re-election campaign last year, but are proving deeply unpopular. His cabinet says the changes are essential to prevent the pension system from falling into deficit and younger people carrying the burden. Macron's centralist alliance has the most seats in the National Assembly, but lost its majority in legislative elections last year. Therefore, it needs to count on the support from the right to be able to pass the bill. Another option for the government would be to use a special constitutional power to force the bill through without a vote. This is a risky choice because such a decision would be highly unpopular.
Since the war in Syria began in early 2011, Western nations and their regional allies have left no stones unturned to topple the Syrian government. These efforts were led by the U.S., which coordinated the efforts of the Western and Arab nations against Damascus. But the U.S. soon began to dispatch its own soldiers and military hardware to the war-stricken nation. The U.S. claimed that the troops sent to Syria were tasked with fighting Daesh terrorists and helped the so-called moderate armed opponents of President Bashar al-Assad. Daesh terrorists were defeated mainly due to the efforts of the resistance front, and U.S.-backed efforts to topple the government in Damascus largely failed. But the U.S. still continues to keep hundreds of its troops in northeast Syria. Over the years, U.S. forces have been involved in the theft of Syria's natural resources, including its oil.
Very importantly, as you know, we have the oil, and we left soldiers for the oil because we took the oil and we're working on that, and we have it very nicely secured.
We've kept the oil. We stayed back and kept the oil. Other people can patrol the border of Syria, frankly, and Turkey, let them, they've been fighting for 1,000 years. Let them do the border. We don't want to do that. We want to bring our soldiers home. But we did leave soldiers because we're keeping the oil. I like oil. We're keeping the oil.
The U.S. regime is also using its troops in that region to coordinate anti-Damascus efforts with the Kurdish militants. By backing the Kurdish-led SDF in eastern Syria, the U.S. controls about a third of the country, an area where most of Syria's oil fields are located. Just recently, the U.S. Chairman of the Joint Chief of Staff, Mark Milley, visited Syria, marking his first visit to the country as a top U.S. general. Damascus condemned the visit as, quote, illegal and a flagrant violation of Syria's sovereignty. Calls are now growing to end the illegal presence in Syria. A resolution was circulated in the U.S. House of Representatives, which called for the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Syria. The resolution was submitted by Republican Matt Gaetz and was supported by other Republican lawmakers. The resolution was ultimately defeated by Congress, but it could be a signal of growing uneasiness with the presence of U.S. troops in the war-torn nation.
I do not believe that what stands between a caliphate and not a caliphate are the 900 Americans who have been sent to this hellscape with no definition of victory, with no clear objective, and purely existing as a vestige to the regime change, failed foreign policies of multiple former presidents.
Syria is not the only country in West Asia that hosts unwanted U.S. troops. Syria's neighbor Iraq is also home to hundreds of U.S. soldiers. Earlier this week, the Pentagon chief made an unannounced visit to Iraq, where he announced Washington's intent to maintain its military presence there. Austin is the most senior official in the Biden administration to visit the country. The presence of U.S. troops in Iraq began in 2003, after Washington invaded the country. March 19, 2003, the U.S. and Britain invaded Iraq in blatant violation of international law under the pretext of finding weapons of mass destruction. But no such weapons were ever discovered in Iraq.
The objective is to compel Iraq to destroy its illegal weapons of mass destruction and its programs to develop and produce missiles and more of those weapons. Saddam is dangerous. The world would be a better place without him. But the reason he poses a growing danger to the United States and its allies is that he possesses chemical and biological weapons and is seeking nuclear weapons. And unlike my colleague from West Virginia and Maryland, I do not believe this is a rush to war. I believe it's a march to peace and security.
Indeed, the facts and Iraq's behavior show that Saddam Hussein and his regime are concealing their efforts to produce more weapons of mass destruction.
At this hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq, to free its people, and to defend the world from grave danger.
According to the California-based investigative organization Project Censored, more than 1 million Iraqis were killed as a result of the U.S.-led invasion and occupation of the country. The U.S. withdrew its forces in 2011, claiming that it had ended its combat mission in Iraq. But hundreds of U.S. troops still remain inside the Arab country on what Washington describes as an advisory mission. Following the U.S. assassination of Iran's anti-terror commander, General Qasem Soleimani, and his Iraqi trench mate, Abu Mahdi al-Mohandas, Iraqi parliament passed a resolution that called for the withdrawal of all U.S. troops from the country. However, Washington kept its force inside the country in defiance of a resolution. The U.S. military declared the end of its combat mission in Iraq in December 2021, but it still maintains a number of troops there under the guise of playing an advisory and training role.
Chinese President Xi Jinping has strongly censured the U.S. in a speech at an annual summit of the ruling Communist Party. He said Washington is leading a campaign to suppress and contain China's development. Xi, who will begin his third consecutive term as the country's president, said Beijing faces unprecedented challenges from the West.
Western countries led by the United States have implemented all-round containment, encirclement, and suppression of China, which has brought unprecedented severe challenges to our country's development.
The Chinese president said during the past 5 years, the West has imposed a new set of hurdles that threaten to weigh down China's economic growth. The U.S. and its allies have imposed curbs on tech exports to China, prompting Beijing to double down on the need to shift away from imports for sectors perceived as vital to national security, including semiconductors and artificial intelligence. The U.S. is also working to expand its restrictions on the export of chip-making equipment to China. Xi said China must have the courage to fight as the country faces profound and complex changes in both the domestic and international landscape. He urged private firms to take the initiative to pursue high-quality development.
I've always said there are two critical areas for China. One is to safeguard our rice bowl, and the other is to build up a strong manufacturing sector. As a great nation of 1.4 billion people, we must rely on ourselves. We can't depend on international markets to save us.
Earlier this week, Xi vowed to bolster China's manufacturing capacity and said the country should be able to fend for itself. Later, China's new foreign minister reiterated the president's forceful language on U.S. containment. He warned that conflict and confrontation with the U.S. is inevitable if Washington continues its reckless approach.
The United States claims to be competing to win against China rather than seeking a conflict. But in fact, the U.S. so-called competition is total containment and suppression, a zero-sum game in which you die and I live. If the U.S. does not hit the brakes but continues to speed down the wrong path, no amount of guardrails can prevent derailing. There will surely be conflict and confrontation.
The foreign minister also noted that the development of other countries would not undermine that of the U.S. Overall, the U.S. administration of Joe Biden has shown little interest in cooling tensions with China and frames its engagement with Chinese officials as managing of competition rather than an effort to resolve issues. In Washington, John Kirby, the White House national security spokesperson, brushed off the criticism and said the United States does not seek confrontation with Beijing. He said, "We seek a strategic competition with China. We do not seek conflict. We aim to compete and we aim to win that competition with China, but we absolutely want to keep it at that level." U.S. officials often speak of establishing guardrails in the bilateral relationship to prevent tensions from escalating into crises. Relations between Washington and Beijing deteriorated sharply after former U.S. President Donald Trump launched a trade war against China in 2018. China hoped for an improvement in relations under the administration of Joe Biden, but this never happened. The U.S. continued its hardline policies toward China under the Biden administration. China has repeatedly rebuked the U.S. for its growing nexus with Taiwan, as it regards the self-ruled island as its sovereign territory. The South China Sea, as well as the Ukraine war, are other sources of friction between Beijing and Washington. Bilateral relations soured further last month after a suspected Chinese spy balloon floated in American skies and was shot down by U.S. fighter jets. Beijing is critical of Washington's handling of the issue. According to some senior Republicans and U.S. military leaders, there is a growing concern that a full-scale conflict between the two superpowers is imminent, with the Asia-Pacific and South Asia regions likely to be the primary theaters of the conflict. That's because, besides boosting ties with Taiwan, the U.S. has also significantly increased its military activity in the South China Sea and other waters near Taiwan and China, causing Beijing to do the same, turning the region into a potential flashpoint for war.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment. Allah, Allah,
Allah, Allah, Allah. این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می‌کند ذکر خدا، ذکر الله تطمئن می‌کند.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah.
I request all the distinguished ulama, the children of the Quran, and the eminent scholars not to be negligent of this sacred book, the pious ones, thirsty of guidance, presented as a gift to the lovers burnt with the guidance of Allah, a spark of guidance they have acquired from the light of piety of this gushing spring of guidance for the pious. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear audience. You are listening to Spring of the Truth from IRIB English Radio. In this program, we try to shed light on some of the words and sayings of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh about different topics and contexts. We hope that in that way, we as the lovers of this great character would come to a deeper understanding of Imam Khomeini's thoughts and ideologies. Well, on the subject of the religion of Islam, in one of his speeches, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi said, "We must try to break down the walls of ignorance and superstition so that we can arrive at the limpet of fountainhead of the pure Muhammadian Islam." This speech is about superstitions and how much they can hinder a person's moral growth. One of the most dangerous threats for a religion is for it to become mingled with superstitions. They are beliefs that have neither a divine source nor a mental justification. When people follow superstitions, generally they tend to accept any illogical issue with no thought. A faithful person would never do so because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam, have constantly reproached a superstitious person.
Ya Rabbana, salli ala Taha al-Nabi wa alihi sallallahu alayhi.
When the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam lost his child, simultaneously there happened an eclipse, and some superstitious people started to say that this eclipse is a sign of nature's mourning for the Prophet's loss. When Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam heard that, he became angry and rejected that idea. He declared that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala condemns superstitions and has ordered in his holy book of Quran, Surah An-Nahl, verse 125, invite to the way of your Lord with wisdom and good advice and dispute with them in a manner that is best. Here Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh is in fact warning us that following superstitions leads to corruption in beliefs and keeps human from reaching the pure sense of Islam. That's an important point, especially in the modern time where there is no certain boundary between lies and truth. And you can see that negligence is one result of following superstitions, and it has been condemned and introduced as the key for evil in Islam as well. Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh knows how much negligence can be harmful to a believer's ideas and religion.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Hello everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent, a weekly show that aims to address the most significant issues in the South Asian region. And in today's episode, we will be discussing two major issues: the latest visit by the German Chancellor to India to foster trade relations between the two countries, and also the growing trade relations between Iran and India and Chabahar as a strategically important port. So stay tuned.
In this special episode of The Subcontinent, we will discuss the latest visit by the German Chancellor to India to foster trade relations between the two countries. And we shall also take a look at the growing trade relations between Iran and India and Chabahar as a strategically important port.
The German Chancellor on his recent visit to India said that Germany wants to get New Delhi to support or at least not block Western efforts to isolate Russia for the war in Ukraine. On the other hand, New Delhi has been maintaining a neutral position with regard to the Russia-Ukraine war. India's oil purchases from Moscow have also sharply risen in the last 1 year, with the Indian Foreign Minister Subrahmanyam Jaishankar recently describing India's relations with Russia as extraordinarily stable in the midst of all the global political turmoil.
In the recent meeting with the Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi, the German Chancellor Scholz stated that developing countries were being negatively impacted by energy and food shortages resulting from the Russia-Ukraine war, and hopes that India will help secure critical supplies to Asia, Africa, and the Americas. Maintaining India's stand, Prime Minister Modi said India wants the conflict to be ended through dialogue and diplomacy and is ready to make contribution to any peace initiative. In 2022, when the UN General Assembly voted to condemn the Russian invasion of Ukraine, India chose to abstain from voting, thus shocking Germany and other Western governments. On February 24, 2023, 1 year since the start of the war, India again abstained from voting on a UN resolution calling for Russia's immediate withdrawal from Ukraine. The Indian government under Narendra Modi has made it clear that it does not support sanctions against Russia and will continue its stand against the sanctions. Prime Minister Modi has refrained from any overt criticism of Russia, as Moscow is a major supplier of arms, oil, and India's other economic needs. Given the long history of military interventions by the West around the globe, its criticism about the Russia-Ukraine war is seen as hypocrisy by many countries in the global South.
On the German Chancellor's maiden visit to India after assuming office last year, India and Germany have discussed ways to boost bilateral economic cooperation. However, Germany's turn to India appears strange, given that the European country shares close economic ties with China, the main buyer of German machine tools, and also Russia, which has been its key energy supplier. Both these countries have played a significant role in German prosperity over the past 15 years.
Olaf Scholz, during his visit to India last month, said he supported a free trade agreement between the European Union and India. The business delegation, comprising of some 1,800 German companies, visited India to sign trade deals with a focus on investment in green technology. Germany has signed up agreements with India in the digital technology, the telecommunications center, and diversification of supply chains. In his statement, Scholz said that Germany welcomes skilled workers from India, especially in information technology and software industries. According to foreign policy experts and diplomats, Germany is India's largest trade partner in the EU and has dependably been among India's top 10 global trade partners. The total bilateral trade between the two countries stood at $24.8 billion during 2021 to 2022. For the EU, a free trade agreement with India would fit its strategy of increasing engagement within the Indo-Pacific region, where the bloc is targeting bilateral deals to take advantage of expected higher economic growth. The deal could also act as a counterbalance to China's growing influence in the region.
Now, to have more insight on this, we are joined by Associate Professor in Political Science, Dr. Mehnaz Najmi from New Delhi. Thank you for being on the program, Mrs. Najmi. Now, the recent visit by the German Chancellor to India coincided with the first anniversary of the Russia-Ukraine war. So the question is Germany trying to seek Indian support to isolate Russia?
Yes, I feel that it is trying to isolate Russia by taking Indian support. German Chancellor Olaf, he visited India during G20 summit, and there he tried to influence the Indian's decision of buying oil from Russia. He tried to persuade him he kept telling the media persons here, he was trying to give an indirect message that India should not be buying a lot of oil from Russia, and they should be overtly or coming out in order to criticize the policies of Russia towards Ukraine. So what Olaf tried to do, he tried to isolate Russia by taking India into confidence. But here is a thing that India won't do anything like that, and there is no point of doing this kind of thing, especially for the European Union. India is an independent sovereign country. We have our own decision making process. We have our own foreign policy. We have our national interest, and we, our prime minister, wanted to safeguard our national interest rather than getting influenced by somebody else for somebody else's interest. There is no point doing it. Though German chancellor tried to persuade him to at least openly criticize the Russian stance of attacking or waging a war over the Ukraine. But here,